I'm going to talk about an approach to learning about the core physical quantity that governs gene regulation, namely the energetic affinity between transcription factor and specific stretches of DNA, and how to learn something about that from information that is only indirectly determined by the numbers that you're interested in. So I'll work my way into this slowly. So what I'm talking about is how to extract information about transcription factor DNA binding from binding assays. That is to say, these things that people are now, experimental biologists are now able to do, in which they interrogate in a massive fashion whole genomes and acquire information that is somehow reflective of the affinity of transcription factors for particular stretches of DNA, but doesn't directly read out KD, okay? And we'll come to what's up in greater detail. So why are we interested? Well, transcription factors are DNA binding proteins which regulate gene transcription. They're not the only mechanism for governing gene expression, but certainly they're a key mechanism in all organisms. And I would take the approach that Terry Waugh was espousing yesterday. You know, you're a physicist, so try to focus in as closely as you can on something that you know to be important and try to understand it in detail. A quantitative understanding of gene regulation and its evolution, which is going to be the subject of the next talk, is certainly going to require a quantitative understanding of transcription factor DNA interaction. And I think the amusing thing about what Villa is going to say is how the word quantitative understanding and evolution intersect when you take a particular path. So what we're interested in, therefore, is the sequence-dependent binding energy of a transcription factor for DNA. I mean, obviously, specificity is key. You have to somehow get this thermodynamic mishmash to decide that I want to bind to this particular location in the DNA, and that particular location is singled out by the fact that it's got some specific sequence, more or less. Now, high-throughput experiments can give massive amounts of information on this issue, and I put in parentheses, rather noisy, because that's going to play a key role in the discussion that follows. So the two types of massive data accumulations that we'll talk about are either protein-binding microarrays, and I'll give a capsule description of how they work and what sort of information they give you, or so-called chip-chip chromatin immunoprecipitation microarray data. These all tell you, you know, something quantitative about how a particular transcription factor binds to however many snippets of DNA, different snippets of DNA you've managed to lay down on some kind of interrogation device. For purposes of thought, let's imagine that what you lay down is the DNA for every upstream region of every gene in your genome. So, you know, order 10 to the 4 spots, and you get n 10 to the 4 pieces of information out. They're numbers, and the question is what to do with them. And the distinction between these two methods is that one of them is purely biochemical. The PBM is in vitro, and all you got is the protein that you're interested in and DNA that's being interrogated, and there's no helper stuff around. Whereas chip-chip takes place in the living cell, ultimately, and is therefore troubled by all of the interfering and confusing effects that go on inside a cell. So you're not doing a direct biochemical assay. And we are going to, so to say, we will be able to use the two kinds of data set in the analysis that we'll describe, and it will be very interesting to essentially compare what you learn about the in vitro, what you learn from the in vitro and the in vivo approach. Now, the usual goal of accumulating all of this data, the goal that I think a sensible biologist would say is what he or she is after, is to use this data to identify those specific places in the genome where the transcription factor does something useful, the transcription factor binding sites. We're going to do something that is only indirectly related to that, and for good reason. Our goal is to infer not the binding sites. So the finding a binding site is a yes-no question. This thing is or isn't a binding site. And we're going to try to infer something rather different, namely sequence-dependent binding energy models from this noisy data. In other words, we want to learn a function. You put in the stretch of DNA that's being interrogated, and out pops, you know, 0.327 kT, okay? And you put in another sequence, and out pops another number, 0.596 kT. We want a function. And that function doesn't tell you this is a good binding site or not. It just tells you what the affinity is. But you can see why that's a useful thing to know. Terry's talk yesterday, in fact, shows how the functioning of a whole gene switch, at any rate, ultimately can be referred back to a knowledge of what that binding affinity is for a certain collection of transcription factor binding sites. Now, somehow there's a methodological goal or thread to what we do, and we are, as I say, going to try to infer models of the energy, of the binding energy, from noisy data, and we're going to take an approach which is dead common in physics and cosmology, namely, we are going to take the data as not giving you the answer, but giving you a probability distribution on answers, okay? And why that's a good idea, we'll see ultimately. In other words, it's unlikely, or it's probably not a good idea. It's not a good idea in high-energy physics, it's not a good idea in cosmology to say, I have the answer. You always see, you know, somebody's trying to determine the age of the universe, the value of the cosmological constant, and some other things, and what you'll see plotted in the paper are ellipses that say, well, with 95% confidence, it's somewhere in here, and then some other experiment comes along and produces a different ellipse that has the 95% confidence level, and they intersect, and if you've done things right, that intersection actually allows you to refine your understanding. We'll use this probability distribution in model space perhaps in a slightly different way than is common for, or understandable from what physicists do. To try to address a question that's of interest to biologists, namely, to go back to this, what's an effective transcription factor binding site? Okay, let me launch into a short interlude on tendentious philosophy. The binding specificity problem has two classic formulations. It can be, you know, lexical or coding. That is to say, you might ask, is there a statistical sequence pattern, a motif or a position weight matrix, that distinguishes true transcription factor binding sites from random genomic background? As I've already said, we're going to take a different approach, namely the energetic approach. Can we construct an accurate representation of the binding energy of the transcription factor to more or less general site sequences? By the way, if you answer the second question, you don't directly determine the question of function, but biological function is presumably determined primarily by, or it's determined more by energy than it is by some p-value, let's put it that way. So it's probably a good idea to go after energy. The problem is that energy is hard to measure. It really is a pain. Whereas sequence can be looked up in databases these days. Hence, more effort has gone into motif finding than into energetics. And there's a brilliant and puzzling and confusing twist to this whole thing in that 20-odd years ago, Berg and von Hippel gave us an algorithm for turning known binding site sequences, if you have a collection of them, for a particular transcription factor into an energy function. It's kind of merging of these two approaches. And that's wonderful, but the Berg and von Hippel algorithm assumes that the sites evolve out of random background genome under the same selection pressure, a kind of ergodic hypothesis, and the conditions for this, you know, the resulting conditions for the equivalence between the lexical and the energetic approach could easily fail in the sense that as far as the random background assumption goes, there are organisms where the background is so bizarre, like in Plasmodium, where it's all AT and it has long stretches of you know, ATAT, et cetera, and it's not just junk repeats. It really is the way the genome is. It may be that this equivalence in, between the two approaches is not foolproof, and one really should try to do better. Anyway, since binding assay experiments probe energy, it makes sense to try to model energy directly, and the sequence should come along for the ride. Let me not dwell on this more than a microsecond. I just want to flash in front of you sort of the raw material for the lexical approach. If you know a bunch of binding sites, they've got sequences, you can line them up, and you can see something which will, you know, come back to interest us over and over again, namely, these are, of course, not lock and key binding sites. If you line up everybody in a particular position in the site, you will see that there may be some preference for this, that, or the other base, but it's not something unique. There's a statistical aspect of the whole thing. Yeah? Well, first of all, I think the frameworks, the conceptual frameworks are different, and the goals are similar, of course, in the end. Let's see. Why don't we come back to this question in after I've laid out a little bit more, okay? Justin, you wanted to say something. There's a slide in another slide or so further on where we address this question again.
Yeah.
So if energy is the thing that the organism really cares about, then so to say all sequences that give you the same energy or sort of band of energy are in some sense equivalent, and knowing what that entropy is, of course, is going to tell you something useful.
So it's a different conceptual
view. Yeah. No, sure. But let's see. Whether or not, you know, what is the occupation probability of this, for this transcription factor of this particular stretch of DNA is, for example, not determined just by the sequence. It's determined by the concentration of the transcription factor, and there's a, you know, there's a thermodynamic aspect to the whole thing that clearly is driven by energy and thermodynamics, not just by p-value of that particular sequence with respect to the rest of the genome. That's really all I want to make sure is clearly in mind, okay? The key methodological thing in the end is going to be what it takes to extract from the noisy data that's not about sequence directly, but about binding assay or some other variant of that to learn these energy functions. Okay, let me just say a little bit about, to introduce the experimental data that we're going to talk about and try to analyze. This is the protein binding microarray, and basically what goes on here is one spots on an array the upstream regions of, let's say, all the genes of yeast. This is going to, we'll be talking about yeast. You then wash the array with your transcription factor of interest and some of the transcription factors will bind to some of the functionalized DNA, and you eventually wash off the unbound stuff you then wash on a some sort of immunofluorescent probe that binds to the transcription factor, and then you scan the array, and you will learn something about the relative likelihood that there are transcription factors bound to these snippets of DNA in the different wells. And of course, in order to normalize, you better have some kind of relative measure to talk about. That is to say, comparing it with some array of so to say, reference DNA. And you will therefore be able to construct some for each type of DNA, each well, you will measure a log intensity ratio, which is in some way reflective of the number, the binding probability of the transcription factor of interest to that particular stretch of DNA. So you end up with a relationship between sequence and log intensity ratio for a whole bunch of sequences, 6,000 upstream regions, let us say. The correlation between these measured values and whether a transcription factor is bound to the region or not is pretty noisy due to the complicated and, you know, relatively loosely controlled biochemistry. And the question is, how do you interpret this data? What does it tell you? And the CHIP-CHIP assay, which involves a different cut through the problem of measuring what's the relative likelihood that some particular transcription factor binds to some particular upstream region, let's say, in the end produces data of a similar character. For every stretch of DNA that you've interrogated in this fashion, there's some sort of informative log intensity ratio. Okay, well, we're interested in energy, sequence-dependent binding energy. So we, in principle, well, how shall I put it? The function that you might be interested in determining could be arbitrarily complicated, and you're not going to get anywhere unless you sort of decrease, bound the complexity of the function you're looking for. So the function, the most dramatic simplification that you can imagine, and this is the one that's incarnated in the Berg and von Hippel attack on this problem, is the so-called energy matrix, which is to say the assumption that the net energetic affinity of a particular stretch of DNA for the transcription factor is a sum of contributions, sum of independent contributions, one per position in the site, and it is characterized by, at each position in the site, there's a set of numbers that simply tell you the contribution you would get there if you had A, C, T, or G. And for convenience, we'll come back to this. One normalizes things so that the lowest energy in any such, the lowest energy column in each, the lowest energy value in each column is simply normalized to zero. That's not going to have any impact on the kinds of predictions we make. So this is a simplified model for this function that tells me, given an input of a sequence, what is the output? And if you wanted to compress your data through this model, your goal in the end would be to learn something about what are the proper values to assign to this matrix. Yes? Well, the size of the probes are sort of, well, let's call, order 1,000 base pairs on average. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, excuse me. I should have said it. Yes, it's yeast. This particular set of experiments is all about yeast. Okay, so this is, no, this is just the iterogenic regions of yeast. You can do the whole genome, I suppose. But I mean, the point is simply one is interested in learning something about how the transcription factor interrogates the potential locations of promoters and control sequences. Yeah. You couldn't, we'll show you the results of doing either one or the other. The question of combining them to learn further information is an interesting one, and I'm not going to talk about that today, except in, we could do the following if we were energetic enough or something like that. had we but whirled enough in time. Okay, so the other thing, see, to walk my way down this little cartoon, what do we have a parameterized model of the world. Okay, so the parameterized model of the world is this energy matrix. It's a simplification. We do it for purposes of to keep the parameter space, which we have to explore, under control. You could expand the parameter space if you had good reason to do so. Our goal was simply to see how far you would get if you kept your eyes on the most strongly constrained model. Now, the model in the global sense is not completely defined yet. We'll declare a stretch of DNA to be bound if it contains a site with energy less than some number, some cutoff, some mu. And if not, we'll say it's unbound. We're going to use a particular matrix and cutoff to essentially throw every intergenic sequence into one of two boxes. It has a site in it somewhere that, let's say, is predicted to have an occupation probability greater than a half, or it doesn't. Okay? We're just making a dichotomy. So the model is simply used to make a dichotomy. Sites either are, or rather a region, an upstream region, either does or doesn't contain a snippet of DNA that has, according to this model, an energy which is less than the cutoff. So the model, therefore, makes this binary prediction. And the question in the end is, okay, how does this compare with what you actually see in the experiment? Does any choice of model in any way explain the data? Okay, so what's the model? The model, a bunch of parameters are chosen for the matrix and for the cutoff, and they essentially assign to each sequence a yes or no, the sequence being a whole upstream region. So that's a set of binary numbers, and the experiment assigns a set of continuous numbers to the same sequences. You read out the log intensity ratio for those upstream regions. So these data collections are quite different in character, and you want to learn something about what happens or what is the proper way to bring them together. Yes? Yes, 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 yes. That's slide 13. Okay, so we're simply, exactly, you could do a more refined job. However, the actual procedure I'm going to tell you about says we're going to be very rough about it. We're going to simply make a binary decision. Okay? The model will... Well, you could argue that. You'll see what the issue is. Okay. Now, whether I make it binary or continuous, I still have to connect data of completely different type. Okay? You know, one is an occupation probability, perhaps sliced and diced into some set of levels, and the other is log intensity ratio. Okay? They're just different things. Yeah. Well, we don't care. Of course, you know, in the end, we're really, presumably, I hope, non-specific binding in an energetic sense is well separated from the, so to say, the binding energy of the truly interesting binding sites. Okay, and so I don't specifically take into account non-specific binding, although you could say that's just part of your energy function beyond a certain. Above a certain value, you simply say the value is constant. Okay? Well, I'm going to be a bloody-minded person and say, they haven't shown me that, and I'd be willing to bet that it's not. That is to say that, sure, if you did a in physics, of course, you know, depending on what's the underlying process, you can really beat things down to either thermal noise or quantum fluctuations, and you can make measurements that show you that the variance in whatever you measure follows some well-understood basic physical law, and you've taken out all of the technological noise or experimental idiocy noise. Okay, here I don't think you can do that, and so what we're in effect is being agnostic to start with about what is the actual noisiness in the experiment. We're going to quantify it, and I'll do that right here, and then try to make some to develop a procedure which will allow us to actually infer, when we're all done, what that noise function must have been. Where it comes from is another matter. We don't care. Well, it won't be cDNA, because this is upstream. Well, maybe our message is relax. Allow me to go through this part. Not that I can. Okay. So how would you connect this theory and that kind of experiment? Well, the fluorescence log intensity ratio of a particular region, bound or unbound, certainly is probabilistic, at least due to uncontrolled variation in the experimental procedure. If we're talking about the universe, it's cosmic variance. If we're talking about a quantum mechanics experiment, it's quantum mechanics. But here it is something, probably not terribly well controlled, although certainly in any given experiment, if you did things really, really, really carefully and were deeply concerned about understanding the noise, you could learn a lot about it. But it's there. Now, what does this mean? This means that for a given state, that is to say, this particular sequence is in my bound category, I expect that there is some distribution of observed intensities, and if it's in the unbound category, I expect a different distribution of intensities. In a cartoon, something like this. If I'm in state one, then the distribution of observed Zs will be something like this, and if I'm in state zero, not bound, it will look something like this. I don't know the details. I would sort of expect that, on average, if it's a bound, if it's a region that has a good binding site, then, you know, you ought to see a stronger fluorescence from that region. And that's captured, if you will, in roughly these shapes. The experiment actually sees only the histogram of net fluorescence, which is a convolution, it's not really a convolution, it's just an appropriately weighted sum of these two error functions, okay? Because there will be some number of upstream regions that are categorized as bound and some that are a complementary number that are characterized as unbound. And the experimenter, naturally, usually tries to discriminate the two states by essentially putting a cutoff in log intensity ratio on the observed net fluorescence. That is to say, you try to put the cutoff where by some combination of argumentation, you've convinced yourself that stuff to the right is almost certainly drawn from that distribution rather than from that. Okay? Now, that requires that, that's what you would do. So, but let's look at this a little bit more carefully. We've got a particular model in our bag, and we want to know how good is it? How well does it do in predicting the data? If we know these functions, if we know these error, we know the error model, then okay, we'll assess the goodness of model M. It makes a bunch of predictions. This region is bound, this region is not, etc. And for each such region, there is an observed fluorescence ratio, and I can pick the appropriate probability that for, if it were, bound, it actually produced that fluorescence. And I can take the product of these like these probabilities over all of the regions, and I can get some net probability of, given a model, that I observe what I actually observed. Okay? And this will be some small number. Bayes' rule then gives you, you can turn it on its head, if you have some prior distribution on models, what is, you know, a priori how likely are different choices of the model parameters, you can turn this around and say, what you're really talking about is, given the data, what's the likelihood that this particular model is responsible for it? Okay, so you can use the data, if you will, to provide a probability distribution on model space. Okay, the X's are yes, no, this upstream region of this particular gene, according to my model, has a site that meets my criterion of falling below the cutoff. Okay? So you just hop along from gene to gene. The model says bound, unbound, bound, 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 unbound. For each region, experiments saw some fluorescence, and you've got your error model. So you just chain together these probabilities, and bada boom, you have the overall probability of these presumably independent events. And then you do Bayes to turn it around to say, okay, this can really be thought of as, given the experimental results, I can tell you the relative likelihood of different choices of the model. This is what, you know, the high energy physicists do for a living every day. It's the whole probe. It's the whole probe. Yeah. Now, of course, 1,000 base pairs. Yeah. Nothing stops you, by the by, from chopping these things up and making a bigger array. It's just that we're theorists, and we wanted to make use of the data, some convenient, good data sets that we're lying about. Okay, in this particular implementation, we did not worry about that, but obviously you should. You could decorate the method by giving, taking into account multiple binding sites. Exactly how I would do it, I'm not 100% certain. For the cases we've looked at, they're relatively rare, so it doesn't overly bias things as far as we can tell. Okay, but yeah, you could. This is a methodological approach rather than a particular algorithm, if you see what I mean. So if you're taking this cut through the problem, you can adapt this to higher and higher levels of sophistication in understanding what you're doing. 1,000 base pairs, let's say. It's whatever the typical upstream region size is in the non-coding region upstream of a typical yeast gene. Okay, so this is fantastic. I just do all of this. I get this probability distribution on this, you know, 15 by 4 dimensional, 60 odd dimensional model space, and I then use it in whatever way is I find most effective. Now, there's one small problem. We're talking about a probability distribution on model space and using that as a basis for statistical inference. That's great, but the actual error model, these notional functions, which I on purpose drew by hand because they're ratty and we don't know what they are, we don't know them. We have no idea a priori. That's true that people do, in certain classes of microwave experiments, work very hard to learn something about that error model. And you could bring that into play as well. If somebody had done that kind of work for the particular class of data we're talking about, you could even parameterize the error model. That is to say, you could make some rational notion, you could make some rational expectation about what the error model should look like functionally, how many parameters would be needed to figure out what it is. We find, and we'll come to this, that you actually don't have to do that, and I'll explain why. Okay, we've semi-discussed options for more sophisticated modeling, so I don't want to spend more time on that. Okay, so what do we do about the problem that you have no clue, at least in the case at hand, about what the error model really is. Well, if Bayesian analysis, if you like Bayesian once, maybe you'll like it twice. That is to say, we've calculated a model likelihood, or actually the first thing you start with is the likelihood of the data given the model. You require knowledge of the error model in order to compute that function. If you don't know what the error model is, then what the hell? If you have some reasonable prior, that is to say, you know, you're willing to accept with equal, you're willing to accept with some simple prior probability a whole range of possible structures for those error models, then it does seem reasonable, and this is what we do, to essentially calculate the average over all possible error models of this likelihood that we were just computing. So, sounds sort of weird, and it turns out that it can relatively easily be computed. So let me describe what we actually do. Let's see. So in ignorance of the true error model, we'll simply average the data likelihood over all error models to get an error model average likelihood. Okay, to actually do this average, we need to discretize continuous data, and so what we do, therefore, is to, the experimental data are these fluorescence log intensity ratios. We chop them up into bins with equal, we chop them up into bins, I guess, with equal numbers of regions. How many such bins you choose to chop your data up into is something that's, as far as we can see, arbitrary. We, of course, explore different choices. For each bin where you've got a bunch of regions that have log intensity ratios that fall within the limits of your bin, your model simply parses the data. That is to say, it says those regions, well, some of them are regions that I predict to be bound, and the rest of them are regions that I predict to be unbound. All right, so that basically what you've got is a bunch of, so to say, bin by bin by bin by bin, you have some total number of regions, which for convenience we make the same for each bin, and then the model simply divides them into subclasses. Some of them are bound, some of them are unbound. Okay, so there's just a bunch of numbers, and oddly, well, I won't go through the arithmetic, but this averaging over error models is basically at each point, at each bin, basically what's the error model? It's just the probability that a bin, that a site within that log intensity ratio bin is bound. It's just a number that ranges from 0 to 1. So it's not unreasonable to say you're in effect discretizing the error model here, and so subject to overall probability summing up to 1, all you're really doing is simply averaging, when you're averaging over the error model, over the relative likelihood of finding bound or unbound in each region. And, you know, it's a different integral for each different region, because the error model will depend on which, could depend upon which value of the log intensity ratio you're looking at. Yeah. No. So, okay, this says, here I am in a certain bin. I have X is either 0 or 1. What do I know? Let's see, am I saying this backwards? I don't think so. No, at a given, right, sorry. Excuse me. All right, so for a given model decision, bound, let us say, there is a sum of numbers, there's a set of numbers which depend upon Z. The sum of those numbers must be 1. You're absolutely right, because it's, given that it's bound, the probability that it's in any given bin, Z bin, must add up to 1 by the time you're all done. So, yeah, there's a normalization condition on the numbers that characterize the error model this way, and there's a normalization condition this way.
So,
Yeah, the only prior constraint, that is to say, modulo is total probability equal to 1, these individual quantities are simply allowed to run freely. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. We get very sensible answers as it is. This is completely unbiased, okay? I mean, the fact that it works well when you are completely unbiased, I think, is telling you something really interesting. Exactly the details, the full extent of what it tells you, I'm not in a position to reveal at the moment because I don't know. But I think it's worth knowing that being completely unbiased in this regard gets you somewhere. I mean, it's really telling you that there is a fantastic amount of constraint. There's a fantastic amount of information in the combination of this collection of experimental numbers and the knowledge of the sequence. So, yeah, I mean, I think computations could have been speeded up dramatically. I have other reasons for being a little bit skeptical about trying to take some simple parameterization of the error model, which I will come to in a bit. I mean, to avoid all possibility of screwing up, it's worth trying first the option of being completely unbiased in this regard. So that's what we do. We integrate over things which are utterly bizarre and, many things which are bizarre and ridiculous, okay? And there's no, I mean, you know in reality that the error model here should be very close to the error model here. Things that are neighboring in Z ought to be sort of similar to one another. We don't put that constraint on. Let the data tell us if that's what it wants. Why not? Okay, now, so let's see. Given a model with all of this, we can calculate, given data, we can calculate the relative likelihood of a model. What we really want, though, is the, so to say, full picture of what is this, how does this likelihood vary as you move around in model space? And ideally, we'd like a distribution of models in model space that are weighted by this probability distribution that's ultimately determined by the data, okay? And the way to do that is to use a technique called Markov chain Monte Carlo, which, you know, some of you are vastly more familiar with than I am, but it's a, you know, what do? Well, you constrain the matrix of the elements of the energy matrix to live in some conveniently defined box, and you let the cutoff live in some conveniently defined box. You choose some convenient starting value for the model, that is to say matrix and cutoff, and that's to save time. Then you go through a schedule of trying out small increments to the various parameters in your model, and basically you do what Metropolis tells you to do. That is to say, if you calculate the value of this likelihood of the model given the data at a particular choice of the model, then you make a change, you make an increment, and you ask yourself, did you improve the likelihood by making this change in the model? If it did, you accept. If it worsens the likelihood, then you accept with a certain probability, less than 1, which is p old over p new. And if the increment takes you outside the box, you reject and try again. This is the standard Metropolis kind of approach, and in the long run, as you wander around in model space, we may all be dead, but in the long run, you will get an ensemble of models that are, in fact, guaranteed to be distributed according to the desired probability distribution. It's not a normalized distribution, but you don't care, because what you're going to do with it is to calculate ensemble averages of stuff. Calculating the normalization integral of probability distributions is very hard, but fortunately we don't care. That's most things that were of interest to us, we want ensemble averages of something, and that simply means, you know, take the thing of interest, calculate it for every model in your distribution that you've generated by this Markov chain, and take the average over that, and that's a good that's an approximation to the value of that mean according to the desired probability distribution. At the very end, we perform a little dance in which we make use of a certain gauge invariance, that is to say, the predictions are of the model for this kind of data are independent of certain changes that you can carry out on the matrix. Rescaling everybody, cut off a model, doesn't have any effect on whether things are bound or not bound, and essentially making a common addition to the elements in any column of the matrix doesn't change anything either. So you can get rid of all of that in the following way. For convenience, shift so that the lowest matrix element of each column is zero, so that you'll, so to say, see the consensus sequence by eyeball, and rescale so that the cutoff is some convenient value, call it one. This can be done leaving the model predictions unchanged, and this reflects the fact that these beta, where you're measuring log intensity ratio in one instance, are not actually determining the absolute scale of the energy of binding in your experiment. You need to do carefully calibrated experiments at different effective concentrations of the transcription factor in order to see that. Okay, so that's the procedure. And the computation, the hard part is, I don't know wherever it is, compute this guy. Yeah? I don't know how to do any better. Okay, so for a particular, we start at the very beginning on a transcription factor for which this whole procedure behaves extraordinarily well. Now, in general, you expect this to be a good thing to do. It should work reasonably well, you would hope, for transcription factors that are, what is the word, pleiotropic, that have many, many, many binding sites. So, for reasons that I'm not sure the experimentalists, in fact, for these PBM experiments, chose to interrogate transcription factors that, by and large, have lots and lots of binding sites. ABF1, RAP1, REB1, etc. What I'm saying here is that, okay, you don't want to see this in detail now. The Markov chain Monte Carlo estimation procedure converges very rapidly. And one of the things you want to make sure is that you really have found the peak in the probability distribution, hoping that there is one, and that you are really exploring it and not hopping about from different sub-peaks that are widely separated from one another. So there are various empirically, various tests which are sanctioned by authority and experience for checking out whether you've really converged to some well-sampled final probability distribution, and all those tests work fantastically well for this case. Okay, let's talk about results. Yeah? Yeah. On some crummy Mac desktop, for Christ's sake. Okay.
It's not flat.
Oh, well, okay. Why, yes. Now, I didn't say, there's a key result here, or a key observation, or a key blessing, and that is that it does appear that for this kind of transcription factor, this probability distribution on model space is not a mess. That is to say, it yields a well-defined central smooth peak. And it's relatively easily found by this Markov chain procedure. It could have been a total mess, okay? And in fact, it is a total mess if you do the following thing. Take the data and scramble it. That is to say, break the true relationship between log intensity ratios and the genome, just mix it up. Then the whole thing falls apart, which is simply to say that the real genome has a structure built into it. Why it has structure built into it that makes this procedure converge nicely is another matter, but we could talk about that. Don't know. Okay, so let's just, since I'm running towards the end of my time, and of course I've not said more than 35% of what I really want to say, let me just discuss some of the results. Okay, so just to give you a sense of what you find, what I'm plotting up here is a visual representation of the matrix that is inferred from this procedure for ABF1 in yeast. Okay, what do you see? Well, you see, what have we got here? 20 columns, and we have vertically we have a representation of the A, C, T, and G entries for each column, and of course dark blue is zero. So there's a dark blue in every column by virtue of the normalization, and you know what this thing has settled down to is something that has a bunch of dark blues, each sitting in a background of much hotter color, which basically tells you that in this region and in this region, there's a set of bases which are strongly energetically preferred, and then there are other regions where all of the entries are blue-ish, but they're variations of intensity, and that matches very nicely with the motif that you will find if you go looking in the database for this particular transcription factor, but you've got numbers here. What's more interesting from our point of view is that the distribution of the matrix elements that comes out of the procedure is very sharply, has very small variance. That is to say, what's being plotted down here is for each element, we're plotting the root mean square deviation for the number that's up here. And so, you know, on a scale of 0 to 1, which is the range of the energy matrix elements themselves, the RMSDs are, you know, 0.05 is not a typical number. And what's also, so that's what I mean, the word precise that was used in the title refers to that. What you get is information that the data is apparently, when you go at it this way, telling you what the individual elements of this matrix are. It's trying to tell you that it's very sure about their values individually, in this sense. You can look at this in greater detail. All 4 times 20 elements of the matrix, excuse me. By the way, this is the average over the Markov chain Monte Carlo collection of models. And what we have down here is for a particular element. So this guy right here, I'm plotting him down here. I plotted his mean, and I plotted his RMSD, so he's sitting here. And just to give you a sense of what's the quality of the probability distribution that one is getting, here is the histogram of actual values over whatever it was, the 40,000, well, this is drawn from the Markov chain Monte Carlo sample, and you see that you get a nice, clean, sort of kind of Gaussian distribution. You don't have something that's ratty, that has multiple peaks and so on, and that's simply a reflection of the fact that things have, in fact, converged. The data imply a smooth probability landscape in the high-dimensional model space, and that's sort of a surprise. And I think the other thing to say is that, well, no one model is the best model. We can now treat model predictions in a clean, probabilistic way, since we actually have distributions on that are weighted by this likelihood. Yeah. Yep.
So in other words, what discrimination between models or energy values within my model. For example, for the sample from the body can be one position and you find the situation very big, 50% A and 50% B.
Mm-hmm.
You see the sizes of model-like features of this, because of a model that you know, or a model that comes to the first one
model. Well, it doesn't decide. Those different choices will be, they're just different energy matrices in the ensemble. Okay, so they either are the two things that you've described. I mean, you're saying, well, half of them could be it really wants A, and half of them say it really wants C, or all of them could be sort of say indifferent. They give equal weights to A and C. So if that is the case, then that would be, those would be, you know, in the, those would be points that are widely separated in parameter space. And you're saying, how do I discriminate between a probability distribution that has, you know, a smooth peak around one point or widely separated peaks? And the point is, I can discriminate. I mean, the Markov chain will find out, if you give it enough time, whether which of these options is in fact the preferred one. Okay? So it does get discriminated in the end, provided that you've managed to get the, provided that the data are such that this Monte Carlo procedure actually manages to converge. So the evidence so far is that, you know, if it says, if I have a column in the energy matrix where there are two dark blue entries and two very hot entries, so that's saying 50-50. It doesn't care whether it's A or G, let's say. It's saying it really doesn't care. It's not half of the models want A and half of the models want G. All of the models want indifferently A and G. That is to say, the energy matrix has that character. So you can discriminate. Okay, briefly.
What if you run this with a different, you said in the beginning that you have to find a cutoff, but what if you have to find a cutoff?
That's allowed to wander in the Monte Carlo procedure. And then when we're all done, when we found the distribution of models, we normalize everything to a, by rescaling to a common value of the energy, of the cutoff. On, you know, because you can't, the data simply doesn't tell you. You can rescale the cutoff and the energy matrix elements without any impact on the predictions for this kind of data. But presumably there is a physical value for KD. Okay? This is simply to address the question of, well, you guys discretized your error model by putting stuff into bins. And okay, how many, there's the question of how does the answer, how does the result depend upon how finely you've binned the error model? And then there's the question of how does, we have no a priori, well, we actually have a priori knowledge of how big this binding site is, so we didn't take it to be 100, the matrix to be 100 elements wide, we didn't take it to be 5, we took 20. That seemed to be enough to accommodate the expected 15. Does the result depend in any significant way on your choice of discretization bin size or width of the energy matrix? And the answer displayed here is very, very little, surprisingly little, sort of amazing, okay? You can even do the following. You can, you know, if you're particularly bloody-minded, you can take the actual data, the collection of intergenic regions, divide them into two randomly chosen halves, and simply perform your analysis on each one and ask whether your results depend on which half you chose. Again, the answer is no. Now, here's something cool. Yeah. Okay, now I'm going to do something which will cause the biologists to riot. Unless they've completely given up at this point. We can now, so all of that analysis was on the purely biochemical data set. There's the biological data set. There's CHIP-CHIP as opposed to PBM. The character of the data is, to the, you know, if you stand back from it, is indistinguishable. It's the same kind of data, and you can legitimately perform the same analysis, except that the biologists will say, but Jesus, it's completely different. You have chromatin occlusion, you have this, you have that, you have all of these other things. Let us just, for purposes of argument, imagine that all of those biological things that really are there amount in the end simply to a different error model. Okay? Let's imagine and proceed, because the whole point of our procedure is that we don't have to know what the error model is. We let the data determine it for us. Okay, are we going to arbitrarily decide that I can run over, I started at 05, can I run over to 15? Okay, but at no prejudice to Villa. Okay, good. All right, so we performed the comparative analysis of PBM versus ChipChip. Let's say, compare the, well, so what do you do? You just run the same procedure on the two data sets, and you attempt to rescale the energy matrix for one so as to match as best as possible the other. Why would you want to rescale? Well, you're doing two different experiments, and the effective concentration of the transcription factor has absolutely no reason to be the same in the two. So, you know, who knows what it should be, and rescaling is something which is the best we can do within this particular framework to try to accommodate the fact that the, you know, the concentration and the corresponding chemical potential is different. So we just observe that. We get the best match between our results for ChipChip and PBM for the energy matrix describing ABF1 if we rescale the ChipChip guys down by 75%. Not unreasonable, it's pretty small. And the mean energy matrix over the Markov chain Monte Carlo ensemble is very similar for both guys. And you can, of course, dig in a lot deeper. You can, for each element of the energy matrix, you can plot mean versus RMSD. And on top of that, you can actually plot the histogram of values that came out from the two different analyses. Okay, so here, take the yellow guy. Okay, here's this element for ChipChip. Here it is for PBM. The red and the blue give you the values of mean and standard deviation for that particular element for the two analyses. And here, blown up, are the actual distributions from which that mean and that standard deviation came. I'm sorry, right, exactly. You know, indeed, the means are clearly not the same. So it's simply, this is to pick apart everybody. I'm sorry, so what I'm plotting down here simply is the ordered mean values, okay, matrix element by matrix element by matrix element. I have two numbers that they're plotted at elevations, which are the correct mean value for those matrix elements. They have error bars, which give you their variance. And here is the actual distribution for a couple of suitably chosen examples. And this is simply to say that it's pretty damn amazing. These two different, wildly different experiments give you spectacularly consistent statements about the distribution of the values for those energy matrix elements that the experimental data call for from two completely different experiments subject to completely different, so to say, biological and biochemical constraints. We're pretty impressed by that. The error models of the two experiments, as inferred from the data, are quite different. Yet, the same energy matrix, the thing that's supposed to, you know, the description of the energy function, which is supposed to be a universal, it's the same transcription factor protein in both cases, comes out essentially the same. Okay, so this is an interesting consistency check. Let me come now to another, okay, fine. This is just getting some numbers. Who cares about these numbers? Well, so what do you want to do with these numbers? What you want to do with these numbers is to go back and ask a question of interest to the biologist, namely, okay, what are the actual places where you would predict something important is happening in the genome? What are the likely binding sites? So our point is, in some sense, damn it, something's happened here. This happened to me once before. Okay, excuse me, there's a critical slide, which for some reason, when I do this jump through, disappears from the view. What's going on here? Sorry about this. We'll get it. Where's this bastard? Oh, here it is. Okay. Ah, this has happened to me twice. This slide simply refuses to show itself. It's a shame. Actually, it's the one I like most. But so, now, we have an ensemble of models, and that allows us to address this question which particular sites in the genome are interesting in a statistical fashion. That is to say, we can ask, okay, here's a site out of the ensemble of models that are cast up by the Monte Carlo, what fraction of them say this site is bound? That is to say, its occupation probability is above some cutoff number, the cutoff, and you could then do a histogram of sites as a function of hit fraction. That is to say, what fraction of the models in your Monte Carlo ensemble declare that this particular site is hit? It has an energy less than the cutoff. Okay, so the interesting thing is that this is very, very strongly bimodal. And the models in the Monte Carlo ensemble tend to agree very much, very strongly, on whether or not a particular site is one that is bound according to the criteria of this model. So that's, therefore, you could use this statistical discriminator as a way of picking out the fraction of sites that you would argue are likely to be physically meaningful bound sites, or biologically meaningful bound sites, maybe. The question of what have you learned about the error model, the model predictions can be recast as an effective error model, because for every value of log intensity ratio, I can go and look at how many of the regions in that bin of log intensity ratio are of the bound kind or the unbound kind, and then I can, you know, sort of recast all of that as what is the distribution with respect to Z of the bound guys and the unbound guys. And that, if you normalize it, those are just the effective error models for our that come out of our analysis. And, you know, here's the error model for unbound regions, here's the error model for bound regions. So the two, according to what is cast up by the procedure, interpenetrate in a rather significant way. And if you draw yourself a cutoff in a way that reliably excludes all of the bad guys, you're throwing away a hell of a lot of the good guys. And we can, the point of our model ensemble approach is that it's possible to dig in and with considerable confidence identify down here which regions are good guys and which regions are bad guys. You don't throw away so much useful data. Okay, so that's that. PBM versus chip. Okay, and then another biologically important point. When the experimenters who do what they should be doing have to do, namely discriminate regions that are significant, regions where the transcription factor is doing something useful from those that don't, when they make this discrimination by cutoff and two competing experiments, the PBM and the chip, ask, well, how well do we agree? What do we say? So here's, you know, here's the direct region comparison. This blob is the collection of regions that the PBM experiment says have a binding site, and this is the blob the chip experiments, using their choice of cutoff, say, are have binding sites. They're not grossly inconsistent, but they're not spectacularly consistent either. And I think we can understand why. It's because they have had to, by virtue of this way of analyzing things, throw away lots of perfectly good regions. Digging in, making use of our ensemble statistics, we can identify regions that have a binding site by simply declaring sites flagged by more than 50% of the energy matrices to be putative binding sites. We could make it tighter if we wanted to. And here's what you get when you do that. The green, the big circle is the sites that are so flagged by the PBM data analysis, and the purple is the sites that are so flagged by the chip. Fewer sites, but almost perfect inclusion. Okay, so the two experiments actually, if you look at it this way, really do agree perfectly. And the general lesson is that if you somehow manage to understand the noise, you can safely dig into the region of ambiguity and dig out more information about the interesting sites. And the general lesson is that noise can be understood if the data was bottlenecked through a good parametric model, that the difference between in vivo and in vitro experiment can be captured this way is a nice surprise. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, excuse me. No, these are numbers of sites. Numbers of sites. This is sites, this is regions. Okay? The experimenters, of course, have a number attached to a whole region. And they will say somewhere in that region there's going to be a binding site if its log intensity ratio is bigger than some cutoff. We do a different thing. We say, here's a site. It either is or is not, according to our by our lights, a bound site. Yeah, right. Right. Absolutely. And the cutoffs are different. That's why there's inclusion. Okay. There were no free parameters in any of this. We didn't adjust anything to make this come out. Yeah, the number of genes. There is a number.
Is there like one or two?
So divide by 2. So it's 500-600. In fairness to Villa, let me just try one more thing. Okay? Two more minutes. We don't have any direct information about how well this analysis generates an energy function. It gives us some numbers. We use it to classify sites or regions as bound or not bound, and you know that works really well. But you know, does the prediction of this site is, you know, its binding energy is 3 times the binding energy of that site, does that prediction hold up? We have no direct evidence. Someday somebody will do massive measurements of KDs for different binding sites, and that'll be interesting. We looked at a surrogate for this question of do we actually predict energies well by trying to bring in evolutionary evidence. And so this will bear at least a little bit on what Villa is going to talk about. So since you're all biologists, you will have no trouble in understanding this plot instantly. So you can do the obvious thing. You can ask, if your best shot at understanding the energy has told you that, well, there's a cutoff and there's a set of sites that lie below the cutoff and there's a vastly larger set of sites that lie above the cutoff, and I would like to assign functional significance to the site that lies below the cutoff. I'd also like to assign meaning to the energies that I give them. Hard to do. I can now do the following thing. I can say, well, let's compare two species that are reasonably far apart from one another, like Cerevisiae and Baianus, and let us now find for each site in Cerevisiae let's find its orthologue in Baianus, assuming that such exists. And you know, alignments are good enough so that it's not so hard to find such things. And then let us ask, how well does the number that we're assigning to energy seem to be conserved as you go from site in Cerevisiae to its orthologue in Baianus? If your energy function is complete hogwash, then there should be very little correlation. Okay, so, and here's what you find. You find that there is a well-defined population of sites that are below cutoff in Cerevisiae, and a very large fraction of them, better than 75%, are below cutoff using the same energy matrix in Baianus, even though the actual sequences of the individual sites between the two genomes are substantially different. There's 50% probability of a mutation. So there's clear evidence of selection pressure on binding site energy, and selection pressure on binding site sequence is real but indirect and filtered through energy. And you know, this is a pretty spectacular linear filter, if you want, for something that identifies a quantity that the organism cares about and is meaningful and relevant to selection. So that's almost certainly got to be energy, but you know, we don't really know that it is. But in any case, it's a precise genotype-phenotype. It's a genotype-phenotype map that has a lot of precision in it, and it's a good starting point for a quantitative study of how transcription factor binding sites and ultimately, we hope, regulatory networks evolve. So this will be pursued in Villa's talk, and I've run well over my time, and I just have to leave all other things for a later date. Okay, thanks.